Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest for January 17th, 2019, the Pocketing Your Notes edition. I am David Plotz of Atlas Obscura. I'm in Washington, D.C. Emily Bazelon of the New York Times Magazine is on the West Coast, which means it's hella early, as you Californians say, wherever you are, Emily.
Now I'm here for 2 days. I'll be a Californian. Exactly. It is really early. It's true. But here we are, ready to go.
Can you tell us the nature of your visit to the West Coast?
I am visiting the great Stanford University to do some reporting for an upcoming New York Times Magazine article. I really hope it is an upcoming New York Times Magazine article. There are a lot of really smart people at Stanford. That's my big discovery.
Oh, yeah. Oh.
That other voice, of course, is John Dickerson of CBS This Morning, who's in New York.
Hi, David. Sorry to just clamber in the middle of your carefully orchestrated opening.
Are you done now? Can we get the show going? On this week's show... The shutdown continues. The State of the Union is in doubt. How is this crazy situation going to resolve itself? Then, the extraordinary revelation that the FBI opened a counterintelligence investigation to determine if the president was acting on behalf of Russia, and that it was not even the most disturbing news about Russia and Trump this week, I would argue. Maybe not even the second most disturbing news about Russia and Trump this week. Then the House of Representatives moves to dissociate itself from Steve King. Even Republicans are moving to dissociate themselves from Steve King. Why now? What did he do? Why did it take so long? Plus, we will have cocktail chatter. And a reminder, dear GabFest listeners, those of you who are going to be in D.C. or near D.C., on Wednesday, March 27th, we are going to do a live show at the Lincoln Theater that night. Go to slate.com/live for information and tickets. And it is going to be a special show. We're going to do our regular great GabFest of the week, but you're going to get a preview, an advanced look at Emily's fantastic new book, Charged, the New Movement to Transform American Prosecution and Mass Incarceration. It's going to be 2 week early preview. She's going to talk about the book and she will sign your book. So join us on March 27th at the Lincoln Theater, slate.com/live to see the show and to support Emily.
It's my book kickoff. I'm totally excited for it.
Wow.
Doing a better job of selling it this week since last week. I was all nervous about it, but now I'm totally excited that that's my first
kickoff.
Yeah, exactly.
Here we go.
Sunday.
The president called back 50,000 federal employees to work without pay, including more air traffic controllers, some people in the IRS, some people to issue permits for offshore drilling, of all things. These are people who were not deemed essential, but because the shutdown is dragging on and on, the president was like, screw it, they're essential. I want this to be done. We're not going to pay them. They can come do their work. The shutdown now in nearing 4 weeks long as we tape is a total mess. Nothing is happening. We have government workers who are truly starting to suffer. They've lost millions and millions and millions of dollars in pay. We have people who receive federal benefits, whether housing benefits or food stamp benefits, who have lost or at risk of losing necessary funding for their lives. We have the first time in American history that we're not paying members of the military to serve. The Coast Guard is not being paid right now, yet has to interdict on our borders. TSA workers are frustrated. Air traffic controllers. I saw the head of the air traffic control organization saying that she believes that flights are less safe now because air traffic controllers are working at the edge. Meanwhile, a federal judge has declined to give federal workers who are being forced to work without pay the right not to work. But if this continues too long, I think we can get ready to hear about involuntary servitude. And then we have the news, of course, that Nancy Pelosi has essentially declined to invite the president to the House to give his State of the Union address, citing the fact that security forces, security necessary will be stretched because these people are working without pay. And then before I get to John, Emily, I just want to close with this amazing example of how screwed up the shutdown is that I read in one of the articles about it. So the White House has to notify these 800,000 people that they would not be paid. And so they made an initial notification. They have to make another notification again now that they're going to be not paid again. But agency officials do not know how to notify their employees, some of whom are working outposts around the globe. They cannot email these workers because the employees are not allowed to check their work email during a shutdown. The OMB held a conference call with a number of agencies Tuesday to to discuss how to proceed, but could not come up with a solution. One idea was to send a certified letter to 800,000 employees, but because of the shutdown, the agencies lack the money to pay for the postage. It's insane, John Dickerson. That was a question.
Yes, it is insane, David. And there we have our ending. You know, and then Thursday morning, there were some soundings outside of the White House. Maggie Haberman wrote in the New York Times that the president privately said, "We're getting killed," and that he's feeling pressure for this. But then there's also, you know, reporting that says he's feeling pressure, but he's not changing his position. And we should note that the polling is pretty clear here on where the country is. The Pew Research Center did a very thorough examination, and the people who disapprove of doing significant more funding to a border wall, it's 18 points deficit between those who are against it versus those who are for it. So if you were supporting a policy that was 18 points underwater, usually you would get away from it. Usually you would go talk about something else. In this case, and I've been trying to think through how to say this, and I think this is fair, which is that the president is already, I know I've kind of said this on the show before, but he's already taking emergency measures. And the emergency measures is to put federal workers through this for the purposes of gaining leverage to get his policy about the wall to be put forward. So, I mean, I think to think about that in those terms is important, because it's not only that he has an unpopular policy here, though, but it's not, he doesn't just hold an unpopular policy. He is choosing to have all of this, these ramifications in the furtherance of that policy. That's where we are, and I don't know where we're going from there.
Emily, Nancy Pelosi has called for rescheduling the State of the Union, either to have the president submit it in writing or to only give it after this shutdown has passed. Is that a legit move, or is that just pure theatrics, or maybe both?
I kind of think both. I mean, I think it's a way for Pelosi to signal that she just doesn't need Trump. And I mean, surely it plays well with the Democratic base to, you know, basically like diss him in this way. I can't imagine that we can't muster the security forces for the State of the Union. On the other hand, the government's really strained right now, and it's not as if it has to happen on that particular day. And to allow Trump to continue as if everything is normal when it's really not, you know, you can see why Pelosi would want to call attention to the abnormality of the situation and just kind of shake up the political dynamic. John, what did you think of that move by Pelosi?
Yeah, I mean, it's a power response that has the patina or has the cover of being legitimate by the rules of the president's own arguments for why this shutdown is worth it. The president says there's an emergency. And if the emergency is such a, if there's such a big emergency, then we can't afford the to have the security for the State of the Union. So she's using his own kind of argument against him. It's either an emergency or it's not, having the government shut down. If it looks like basically everything can kind of go along as normal, then the pressure on him to cave lessens. And I think she wisely makes the assumption that for him, one of the, he has not so far shown too much attention to the pressure of people not having their paychecks, the small business loans not going out. The White House this week reported that the economic impact estimate is twice as bad as they thought, a quarter or a half point of growth that may be now gone because of the 4 weeks of shutdown. That has not moved anything, but depriving the president of a huge platform may kind of hit him where he lives. I want to just make one quick point about that. The president gave an Oval Office speech making the case in the biggest platform traditionally available for a president for his policy. His numbers went backwards. The only other times that's happened are things where, like, Gerald Ford gave an Oval Office address about pardoning Nixon. And, of course, that was when he announced that he'd done it, and people revolted, and so his numbers went backwards. But you've got to go back to Ford and Nixon and Vietnam to have a situation where a president gives an Oval Office address, gets to hit the ball off the tee as far as he, you know, possibly can, and his numbers get worse.
There is this notion circulating in Trump world, Emily, that this whole shutdown, okay, yes, there are clearly political damage that the Trump administration is bearing. But it's good because it's shrinking the government. It's hurting the Democrats who work for the government. And it's not hurting the people who vote for Trump and really care about Trump, and that it makes an ideological point that will be good in the long run. Do you think that is motivating the desire to continue the shutdown?
I mean, I hope not, because it just doesn't seem like a good rationale. But I mean, it's possible that is what's going on. Although, honestly, it's really hard to tell. I mean, this doesn't feel like it has some kind of rational end game. It feels like a train that got started and Trump doesn't know how to get off it. And because the numbers are so good with the Republican base, there's nothing yet that's happened that is going to jolt him out of his of the decision he's already made. Yeah, I don't know if it goes deeper than that.
What's going to do it? What's going to do it? I mean, you can imagine that some kind of air tragedy would do it.
Yeah, or the not inspecting food, right? Someone gets sick or dies. Yeah,
I was surprised that not inspecting food hasn't had more resonance. That was the one I thought would be for sure evocative for people.
Well, what
breaks this stalemate?
Yeah, good question. Let me do quickly on the food thing. I think they basically brought in some workers and asked them to work without pay. So I think the essential food inspections for the moment are taking place. But there was a study out today or yesterday that said, I think 463 people died of E. coli last year. Basically, one in six Americans are going to get some kind of very bad foodborne illness. The food inspection regime has been in crisis, even when everybody's at work and doing their jobs. And doing part of the job is not just monitoring what's happening in the moment, but trying to think creatively about how to help a situation that clearly is in dire shape. Well, none of that's happening now. So I don't want to suggest that things are okay, but I think they've patched a little bit on that front. What makes it happen? Well, I think you got a couple of things. I mean, you've got basically five Republican senators in the Senate who would vote with the Democrats and reopen the government. You'll start to get pressure from Republicans in the Senate. Mitch McConnell is interesting to watch because obviously having been at the center of negotiations in previous shutdowns, near shutdowns, debt ceiling fights, he's been right in the thicket and he knows how to make the deals. He's been completely out of the limelight on this. He's up for reelection in 2020. He's got a balance between, he's got to balance a lot of different things, but he's not choosing to jump in the middle of this. He could. And there could be basically what could happen is that enough set Republican senators can say, look, your approval ratings, Mr. President, are at 37. And you may think you can get on the right side of this, although 37 is as low in the Gallup poll as his numbers have been since last February. So he's trending at the bottom of his range. The spillover effect here is starting to damage the other Republicans. And that's going to be bad for the party. So I guess that's one of the places where you could have this damage come in. Also, if this is a big, huge thing people can't forget, that it feels like to me could attach to lots of the other Trump chaos. And if at the end of the day, this becomes the kind of thing where people think, gee, that was a huge waste of time with no planning, no strategy, and there was all of this damage done to economic growth and people's lives. I mean, people are not getting paid, and if 80% of the country lives paycheck to paycheck, there are people having to make awful decisions, and we report on them every morning. This could symbolically, for certainly independents and some of the Republicans who voted for Trump just because they didn't like Hillary Clinton, this is the thing. You talk about it once, and immediately it returns everybody to the feeling he was an incompetent president who couldn't do his job.
And if you go back to the art of the deal, and that was how Trump sold himself to voters, this is like a completely failed episode of deal making. And there are, you know, these stories of him walking out of the room. He doesn't seem deeply involved in the details of the negotiations by any means. How do you guys feel about the patches we keep hearing about? I mean, on the one hand, they're preventing harm to people to, you know, by making sure that people can get their food stamps or that food is being inspected. They're staving off some of the worst outcomes of the shutdown. On the other hand, it's like as if the government is open when it's not really open. And of course, all these people are working without pay.
I think I approve of the idea that you can designate a bunch of people as essential and make them, even if they haven't been designated that way in the past, it does seem to me necessary that food be inspected, and it does seem to me necessary that people get their tax refunds promptly. It doesn't necessarily seem necessary that people get their oil leases processed, but can leave that. So I think I'm sympathetic to the idea that the there's some discretion about who is designated as essential and what work is carried on. On the other hand, it's clear, like, if someone works one day without pay, that's okay. If someone works probably a week without pay, that's probably okay. If someone works 10 years without pay, we know that's not okay. So there is clearly a point at which it goes from being okay for people to be working without pay to make sure the government work gets done to not okay. And I suspect we're almost at that point.
No, I assume when you're saying that it's okay even for a day or a week, you're assuming people will get paid in the end.
Well, there's a law was passed that said they will get paid in the end. Not the contractors, but federal employees will get their back pay.
Yeah, the president just signed something. I don't know how many it covers, but one thing...
Which is actually kind of ridiculous. I actually don't think... I'm not even... That to me seemed pretty cavalier. I mean, I guess they have to pass a bill like that, but, you know, the work's not getting done.
Well, but the people who are showing up for work, they should get paid in the
end. Yes, yes, you're right.
Especially,
right.
And you don't want TSA agents feeling super aggrieved and not doing their job because they're never going to get paid for it.
Right. I mean, that's another thing. The TSA agents aren't legally allowed to strike, but if they really step out of work and the airports, you know, aren't functioning, I feel like that's a crisis point we haven't quite hit yet.
I was, the whistle stop this week is the first episode in looking at the shutdowns of 1995. And two things struck me relative to the one we have right now. First of all, in 1995, Clinton and Gingrich were having a graduate level debate about the role of government in American life. And it was about, you know, whether the safety net had been, from Clinton's perspective, too undermined by the Reagan years. And from Gingrich's perspective, it was the safety net that was leading to the problem with welfare and poverty in America. Huge discussions about fundamental issues in American life. And the situation here, while it's incredibly fraught and people are emotional about the way in which the wall is discussed, not as wall qua wall, but wall as a symbol for a mindset about people who are of color or a whole host of other issues, it still is a single – the president is choosing to pursue this policy for a single thing. It's felt significantly smaller than the debates we had in 1995. And then also one other thing, which is that Gingrich, when he got into that debate – it was not crazy to think that he had the country behind him. They had just regained control of the House for the first time in more than 40 years. They'd picked up 52 seats and then 7 seats in the Senate. He overplayed his hand, but he had every reason to think that the country might be with him. The president in this case is facing a massive rebuke in the House races. The country has spoken recently, and they are not buying what he's selling, and yet he continues to pursue this policy in support of a policy that's 18 points underwater.
Emily, last word on this, just going to the legal question here. At what point will a court be willing to step in and say people cannot work under these conditions or they are entitled not to work under these conditions? Is there any point at which they can step in and say that?
That's a really good question. I don't remember hearing about court cases in the past that challenged the shutdown. But, I mean, obviously, when you think of the longer term of this continuing on, there has to be some moment where people can't be expected to keep working without pay. I mean, I suppose they can just walk off the job and quit. But, yeah, I'm not quite sure what the lawsuit would be, but I imagine someone is thinking about it.
Slate Plus members get bonus segments on the GabFest and other Slate podcasts. You can go to slate.com/GabFest to become a member today. And today we have a special guest. Emily's out at Stanford, and she's going to be joined by Stanford law professor Nate Persley to talk about the Trump administration's plan to add a citizenship question to the census and a federal judge's stinging rebuke of that plan this week in a court case.
That court case is in New York City.
In New York City. So again, go to slate.com/GabFestPlus to become a member today. This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th. Only on Hulu. Just to highlight the four biggest pieces of Russia Trump Mueller news of the week. And let it be said, in any other administration, probably the sixth and seventh biggest pieces of Russian news this week would have been themselves grounds for a Pulitzer Prize winning investigation, possibly impeachment. But so have the standards shifted. But in those first four big pieces of news, it was revealed this week that one, the FBI, back in the early days of the Trump administration, opened a counterintelligence investigation into whether President Trump was working to advance Russian interests. Two, that President Trump has had five private meetings with Vladimir Putin and has made active efforts to ensure no records were taken of these meetings, and in one case even confiscated the interpreter's notes, which were the only records of the meeting. Three, presidential lawyer Rudy Giuliani said on CNN that he essentially conceded that people in the Trump campaign colluded with Russia. He said when he said there was no collusion, he just said all he was saying that Trump didn't collude, which is people took as an implicit concession that, yeah, people around him may have colluded. And fourth, four soon to be confirmed Attorney General Bill Barr said very nice things about Mueller personally, said he wouldn't fire him without cause, but did not commit to releasing Mueller's report to the public or even to Congress. So, Emily, I because I'm slightly sleep deprived, I didn't really understand why the news of the counterintelligence investigation was so important. Why was it important?
Well, there was like a split over whether it was like a huge deal or a nothing burger, right?
Well, can you explain that split?
yes, I just wanted you to confirm, but yeah. No, apparently not. Yeah, so on the one hand, we have known for a long time that counterintelligence is part of the Mueller investigation and that obviously Mueller has been investigating Trump for obstruction of justice. And we also knew that the whole point and scope of the investigation is about what the Russians did to try to interfere with the 2016 election. And there's been lots of kind of assumption and, you know, pretty well-grounded speculation that one of the questions is whether Trump in some way, you know, is compromised and Russia has something on him. We've talked a lot about that. I think the reason this news mattered was that it showed that before Mueller showed up, the FBI had this deep concern about Trump and Russia in the wake of Comey being fired. It's a short period of time because Mueller gets appointed pretty quickly, but the FBI on its own deciding to treat the president as suspect and, you know, potentially a Russian asset in this way, that is shocking kind of on its own, even though when you put it into the fabric of what we already knew, it also seems sort of obvious, like, of course, but we hadn't had it confirmed before.
It's hard. It is hard to know where to pick up on this. But I'm still trying to catch up with what Rudy Giuliani said, by the way, in defense of the president. I mean, this is the person who's supposed to be helping the president. To suggest that he is moving the goalposts is to do injury to that metaphor. I mean, we're not even playing the same game anymore. Remember where we started with this, which was that the very idea that anyone in the Trump campaign, high, low, indifferent or otherwise, was in contact with anyone from Russia for any purpose was once considered such an offensive thing to suggest that it should not even be asked by journalists. Okay, that was where they used to be. Now, in a variety of different places, they have continued to claim that there was no connection. Then that was untenable. Now, basically, Rudy Giuliani is saying, well, sure, there might have been collusion, but it wasn't the president. And that's really what their position was. So that's not what their position was, particularly Giuliani's. He had said that no one at senior levels of the campaign was involved. So obviously, if Paul Manafort was involved, in addition to Don Jr. going to the meeting and Jared Kushner going to the meeting with somebody who was coming, promising dirt from the Russian government on Hillary Clinton, it almost isn't worth restating all of these things, except to say that it is extraordinary for somebody who is defending the president to go out and make a statement like that, given where we have been. And so it's almost too big. I mean, I know it represents a kind of a pattern of the moving of the goalposts, but I just kind of want to say a lot of words to give you a sense of how extraordinary it still is. It also deprives some of the president's defenders, like Lindsey Graham, who has repeatedly said there's been no collusion. Well, if Rudy Giuliani is now saying that only applies to the president himself, then really Lindsey Graham can't go around saying that. And it seems to me Sarah Sanders, I mean, they can continue to say it, but when they're undermined by the president's actual lawyer. So I think that's actually a big deal.
Can I say some more words about this? Because I agree it's a big deal. Steve Vladek, who's a law professor at the University of Texas, had a tweet last night where he said, progression, one, no contact with the Russians. Two, no election-related contact with the Russians. Three, no unlawful contact with the Russians. Four, no collusion with the Russians. Five, even if there was collusion, it's not illegal. Six, Donald Trump didn't collude himself. Like, we really have moved a long way here. I would argue, however, and somebody else, and I can't remember who it was, made this point. I think it was Josie Duffy Rice on Twitter last night, that if, you know, you think of Giuliani as simply a lawyer protecting his client's interest, maybe what he said was like a good lawyer move outside of the context of the presidency. If you're just trying to keep your guy from being indicted and out of jail, then you throw everybody else under the bus.
But it's right. But it's also the case. I mean, the other notable fact I would say about that progression that you described there, or maybe it's a regression you described there, Emily, is that the mood of the country and the country's attitude about this has not changed at all. I don't think that there are notably more people who are now crazed for impeachment or who are now demanding Trump's resignation than there were at the beginning of it. It's I think, an incredibly effective strategy, perhaps, on the Trump administration's part to have slow walked this. I mean, the theory usually is let everything get out quickly first, clear it up, and move on. The dragging nature of it, the massive length of it, the way they have, you know, at every point mounted a new weak defense, allowed it to be overrun, and then mounted another one 100 yards back, they're not in worse shape than they were at the beginning. So, sure, it's they've been exposed as liars and probably criminals, but are they politically more damaged? I don't know that they are.
One thing I've been trying to think through is the toxicity of being aligned with something that's getting all the more crazy. And we'll get to this in the Steve King conversation. But one of the things when you talk to Republican officials who think about speaking out against the president, and remember, he's very popular in his own party. And we see tactically how that plays out when you see Mitch McConnell not doing what he could do to try and end the shutdown, because he's staying on the president's team. At some point, if the entire Trump set of explanations collapses, the members of his party who supported him and stuck with him and all of that, they are going to pay some kind of price. Largely, they haven't. Only a few have, but they will. It could cause them to start making some independent decisions with each new thing in this, and that could change the political dynamic.
Can we change the subject slightly to the strange news about Trump and Putin's meetings, which is also, of course, you know, in the penumbra of this question of whether Trump is working on behalf of Russian interests? So it came out that Trump has had these five meetings with Putin, five private meetings with Putin, essentially, and he has made really extensive efforts to make sure that other people, including his closest aides, do not know what was discussed. And in one case, even went so far as to pocket the notes of the translator. I almost don't even know what to say. It just is so odd. You know, I guess one explanation could be, well, he comes from a world of business. And in a world of business, it's true, you tend not to try to keep extensive documentation of the deals you're doing so that you don't, you know, you don't lock yourself in, so that when litigation comes, you don't find yourself in trouble. So maybe it's just his general way of secrecy about him. But it's.
Although, David, if you were going to go with that explanation, wouldn't you expecting him to do the same with other meetings with world
leaders?
That's
the question.
Like, if it's specific to Putin. Yeah, that explanation doesn't make any sense.
That was my next question, which is: have we found out yet whether when he's meeting with Xi Jinping or when he's meeting with the Prime Minister of India, does he do the same thing? I don't know. Do we know that yet?
No one has said he does. I mean, I suppose it's possible.
Yeah. No one has suggested that. But I mean, that's you're looking for, which is a completely reasonable thing to do, to look for, as you try to, you know, categorize all the possible reasons for this, what's the most benign interpretation of this. He had already had some of his conversations with the Russian ambassador and foreign minister in the Oval Office. That was leaked. You'll remember this is when he let them in on some Israeli intelligence that he wasn't supposed to. So, you know, he might feel like he was burned there and he doesn't want to be burned again. Now, what's also an interesting part of this is one of the key meetings, I believe it was the one in Germany, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson was there. So Tillerson has not talked about what happened at that meeting, but there is another source who is able to be interviewed about that meeting. And the House Democrats are thinking about subpoenaing the interpreter, and you wonder, I don't know whether Mueller would have cause to do that. That's, you know, there are ways that you can find out what happened. And I would be very interested to see, it seems to me the House can make a national security case for why it would be worth subpoenaing the interpreter.
Right, although there will certainly be a claim of executive privilege about that, right? And mm-hmm. we're going to see these clashes repeatedly in the coming months about the subpoena power of the House and what the White House does and doesn't have to turn over. It's not like the House asking for something means that the House is going to just get it.
Sure. Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
I mean, it's quite disturbing that the staff of the White House is so ineffectual and so weak that they are unable to protect this essential national security interest of having the president's words documented and maintained. Because you think about the Secret Service. If the Secret Service tells the president, you know, don't get on this flight now, the president doesn't get on the flight. The president will heed the Secret Service. I think when it comes to security issues, presidents are incredibly respectful of the Secret Service's determination and judgment and counsel. It's disturbing that here are these other people who are experts, who have experience, who are speak for the national interests of the country, and the president just doesn't listen to them, or that they don't exert themselves to tell him, you have to have somebody in these meetings, you have to record them, we have to know what's happening. It's a sign of, I mean, this, your point about incompetence, it's a sign of how incredibly incompetent and careless this government is.
And also, when you go back to the business analogy, the reason that, to me, it seems breaks down is that any business executive who has been a part of a huge organization, which Trump wasn't, I mean, his was a small, it was maybe large in not dollars, but was a small organizational structure. If you've been in charge of a large organizational structure, you know that decision-making can't happen in the mind of one person. And in fact, all of the business, kind of current business thinking now about teams really accentuates this. So it's leaving aside the national security implications. It's just a super disordered way to operate a presidency. Jack Kennedy in 1961 in Vienna met with Khrushchev and only wanted the interpreters to be there. He wanted no aides in the room. That was to create a condition where he could have a kind of heart-to-heart with Khrushchev, who ended up kind of stealing his lunch in that meeting. But he didn't do it for the purposes of keeping everybody else out in the larger discussion. So when the meeting breaks, he goes and talks to everybody about what happened so that they can have an aligned foreign policy that benefits from the best minds being able to put their brains on the situation as it stands. So just from a purely kind of proper way to run a railroad, this is incredibly disordered, and it means that it's very possible that the administration and the person leading it are operating at basically total cross purposes on a key geopolitical matter.
It's also just really strange, like especially because Trump knows that Russia and Russian interference are the subject of an investigation, that there is a swirl of suspicion and questions around him and his relationship with Putin. So it just seems to be quite provocative. I mean, I suppose Trump could have thought that no one would ever find out that we didn't have any record of these meetings. But it's a political risk that he has taken, and it just makes me deeply wonder why.
I thought you just said a squirrel.
Yeah, although that's fine.
A squirrel of confusion.
Which I was excited for a squirrel of confusion. Most squirrels look confused.
Well, squirrely, the adjective kind of fits in that sentence, right?
Speaking of the squirrel of confusion, just, you know, when the president makes more decisions based on his own interests, this is going a little bit back to your argument about Giuliani, David, when he's making decisions based on his own interests and not the country's, that may be his intent, but we are all hooked. Our wagon wheel is still all hooked up to him. He's the president of the United States. And if he starts to make decisions for self-preservation, those could very well be either at odds with his role as the president or, at the very least, putting the country in a position that he's steward of himself, not steward of the office. And that the more pressure that gets put on him, presumably that puts his stewardship role in greater danger and greater pressure.
That is very well said, John. I want to close Indeed. Actually with one question to you, Emily, which is Bill Barr up testifying before the Senate for his confirmation in order to win confirmation as Attorney General. What did you make of his point that he would not necessarily release the Mueller report to the public? And I mean, he was basically signaling he's not going to release it to the public or to Congress, or he's going to try not to. Why do you think he said that? And does that set up a significant fight, do you think, or is he just automatically going to win that?
I found this whole thing confusing because he started off by saying that he wanted to be as transparent as possible, and he understood that it was important for the public to know what the investigation found. And then you're right, there was this kind of wiggling and weaseling out of the idea of sharing it. I mean, there is this two-part process where Mueller makes a report to the Attorney General and then the Attorney General reports out to Congress. And it's not clear that Barr would have to, if he is Attorney General, would have to share everything in Mueller's underlying report to him with the Congress and with the public. And it felt to me like he was going as far as he could to reassure Democrats and maybe some Republicans who want to make sure the Mueller investigation is completed, that there's going to be this incredible hunger and appetite, obviously, for every detail of Mueller's findings. And the fact that Barr wouldn't commit himself to necessarily releasing all that information, it's dismaying. It should factor into the confirmation vote and to how we think of his role. I mean, the other thing about Barr that I just cannot square in my own head is during the hearings, and of course, this made perfect political sense, but he went out of his way to talk about how fair-minded he thought Mueller was. No, Mueller wouldn't engage in a witch hunt. They're good friends, yada, yada. Over the summer, he wrote this like apoplectic memo about Mueller that assumed the worst of him and his investigation in ways that did not at all make room for the notion that this is a fair-minded guy I've known forever who's a friend of mine and I just like give him the benefit of the doubt. Now, maybe Barr wrote that memo because he was auditioning for this particular job or a job like it. When Senator Pat Leahy suggested that, Barr called it ridiculous. But I just can't figure out how the author of that memo is seeming, how I'm supposed to take at face value Barr's remarks now about his faith in Mueller.
Hey, everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024, The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
Steve King, the Republican congressman from Iowa, is being drummed out of polite society here in Washington. King said to the New York Times in an interview, quote, white nationalist, white supremacist, Western civilization, how did that language become offensive? And that statement prompted a storm of anger and fleeing away from him, both from Democrats and from those in his own party. The Republican Party joined with Democrats in the House to rebuke him with a House initiative condemning white supremacy, 424-1, which even King himself voted for. Republican Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy stripped King of his committee assignments, his very excellent committee assignments. Mitch McConnell and Mitt Romney both encouraged King to resign. Meanwhile, Democrats are trying to decide whether they should push for a censure vote or not push for a censure vote. I think the argument for it is that King is a loathsome, reprehensible figure and he should be censured. The argument against it is that it sets up this precedent that you can be censured by the House for perfectly legal speech, legal if offensive speech, and that's a bad precedent to set. So I think the debate around King is really, A, what took so long, and B, is he anomalous in the GOP and in the conservative movement, or does he in fact, is this a little bit of protesting too much, but from Republicans, given how much they're tolerating of this kind of language from the president and from many, many others, either within official Republican Party structure or who are strong supporters of Republican candidates. So John, why now? Why is it that now is the moment that even Republicans feel they have to distance themselves from this guy, who's been very popular and much supported and you know, won re-election easily until this past election?
Yeah, won re-election easily, and who the Republican candidates running for president in 2016 sought to have endorse him, support him. You know, he was integral to the Republican primary process for people seeking to lead the party. And I think we should also say that the context in which this came out, the New York Times story, was one that was essentially saying before there was Donald Trump, there was Steve King. So the mindset, approach, and policies that are at the heart of the president's policy decision to push for border wall funding, even to the point of shutting down the government, that's super closely associated with this person. And so now the House Republicans have decided that he didn't just misspeak, right? I think that's, as I've been thinking through this, let's say he said something dumb out loud, but there was no evidence in the rest of his background suggested that this was anything more than kind of a dumb slip up, or as he tried to argue for it, kind of he was making a rhetorical point. His words got kind of jumbled in the conversation. He didn't really mean this. They would have far less standing to say this, but they made the decision that A, this was not just a random slip up. B, that he was very likely to do it again in some context because the is it the Overton window that's been opened by President Trump? But the things you can say and get around saying, oh, don't be so politically correct, that is really opened. And so he might say it again. And the Republican Party just lost almost 40 seats in the House in this last election, has a very bad reputation with some key constituency groups like suburban women, who will be important for the presidential race and other races. And because of the president, you have a situation where the president's own behavior and actions is supported by the party and ratified because there are people who don't want to split from the president. So you have in a situation where the president ran an ad suggesting basically that Democrats basically loved members of MS-13, and they showed this cop killer in the ad. And it was people found it so offensive that networks didn't run it. Republicans spoke out about how offensive it was. The chairwoman of the Republican Party said there wasn't anything offensive about it at all. That's because she has to back up her president. So if you've got that kind of adhesion to actions being taken by the president, it leaves you much less room to have a Steve King in the world.
And yet, I mean, fundamentally, I think what's going on here is the sort of strain in the Republican Party, which Trump has completely embraced with Jeff Sessions and Steve Bannon, were also spokespeople for this longing for a whiter America, for an era in which the number of people of color in the country was not growing, a kind of vision of America as threatened and declining because it is going to be less white. And the Republicans can't really figure out how to disentangle themselves from that strain of thinking. I mean, certainly there are Republicans who disavow it, but in Trump, they basically have, you know, a champion of that way of thinking. And when you look at all of King's comments and remarks and, you know, endorsement of fringe right-wing politicians, what you see, I think, is that worldview, which is basically, well, it's racist. And it's also, it is white supremacist and white nationalist. And so his willingness to bandy about those words, it's all of a piece. And I don't think you can just, you know, kick Steve King off a couple of committees and say that you've taken care of it.
Right. Although to go back to the Overton window is this idea that you can shift the boundaries of what is acceptable conversation. And in shifting those boundaries, you basically change the terms of the debate and get policy gains. And it is certainly the case that King and I would say Steve Bannon and Donald Trump have been Overton window shifters on race and how we talk about immigration and how we talk about immigrants. And they've been very effective. And so insofar as you can mute one of those voices and say one of those voices is not legitimate and represents something that is anathema to the American idea, that helps shift the window a little bit back towards the direction I think it should go, which is to be more welcoming and not white supremacist-ing. So I don't think it's nothing to. I don't think it's nothing to, even at this late stage, to stand up against him and say his values are anathema.
I don't think it's nothing. It's just not sufficient.
Sure. Yeah. Yes. Definitely not sufficient.
Also, I think we should be. Think about it. We are 10 years, you know, almost to the day of the inauguration of the first African-American president, who was elected by breaking through the system, essentially, in the Iowa caucuses, and then won Iowa as a Democrat, which is a big deal. And you now have a very popular congressman from that state being sanctioned for the determination being made by Republicans that he's okay with white supremacy, which is the idea that white people, by virtue of their skin color, are better than other people. That's quite a distance in 10 years, and I think needs to be talked about in stark terms for all the reasons Emily said and for the reasons, this didn't just come out of nowhere. And regardless of how much you want to apportion blame to someone here or there or the other thing, the nature of the decision the Republicans made was that this was more than just a momentary slip up. Where do they put the origins of this? How do they wrestle with what portion of his character? Because they've just made a conclusion about him. This is more than skin deep. So I think all of these things are I would be fascinated to hear people from his party and who sanctioned him talk about this at more length.
Emily, there is this question about whether Democrats in the House should try to censure him. There have only been, I think, 6 censures in a century. A censure is the step the House takes that's just short of expulsion. I believe the person censured has to stand in the well of the House and endure public shaming. And I can't remember exactly what it is, but it's slightly medieval. But there is this worry that it would set a really bad precedent and that makes censure a tool that will be used lightly. Do you think that the Democrats should do it, or should they do what they seem to be doing, which is to the House leadership seems to want to do, which is push this to the House Ethics Committee, which can then sort of slow walk it and people will forget it and it'll get bottled up and, you know, in 2 months it'll die?
I mean, I feel like there is a really strong argument for treating dehumanizing people and, you know, what John just said, like if you have this mistaken notion, you're really going to go out there and say that some people are better than other people because of their skin color. It's okay to name that as distinct and as worthy of censure in a way that other kinds of behavior wouldn't. I'm okay with that idea that this is distinct and disturbing in a way that demands a particular kind of response and that shaming is actually like perfectly appropriate. I also don't feel super strongly about it. I mean, I tend to not care about these ceremonial responses. And I think what really matters is what John was just arguing about, a reckoning within the Republican Party that goes deeper. I guess the other thing I wonder what you guys think about is this discussion in the press about using the word racist for King's remarks and some amount of what just seemed to me to be kind of like lily-livered, wimpiness about not wanting to use this word. And I feel like this has to do with the Overton window opening up on talking about prejudice, but it reminds me of the debate over using the word lie for Trump, because the notion here is like, well, we can't use the word racist unless we know what was in someone's heart. But if you have this pattern of comments and of endorsements, and it just seems like it's all sitting out there, the evidence is really clear. It seems important to me to use the word racist in the same way that it can be important to use the word lie for Trump. That if you take away these clear words, you're actually obfuscating much more than you're offering. That you're just not doing your job as a journalist. And so I was distressed by that.
Right. I actually think that notion of what's in people's heart is just exactly the wrong thing to think about. In fact, the whole point about racism is that it doesn't, you can be racist in your heart. You can go sit around your home and think, you know, pejorative thoughts about people of different races all you want. And that's fine. That's your right. That is all humans.
It's not so great, actually.
Well, hold on, let him finish.
It's not great, but that's the nature of what humans are. We're base creatures full of vile thoughts and vile beliefs. It's civilization that causes us to restrain those beliefs. And it's the, you know, the rules and expectations of society that cause us to restrain those beliefs and not to not express them and act on them in ways that are cruel, offensive, dehumanizing. And so, you know, I couldn't care less what's in his heart. It is simply the public actions that matter. And so that to me is a non-argument. It does not matter what is in someone's heart. It only matters what they do, because in everyone's heart is a mix of things which are grotesque and noble.
I thought you were going to come around to somewhere else. So I'm back with Emily on the, I disagree on the what's in your heart, but I know that's also, I know you're slightly making a different point, but I'm down for actually, no, it's not good to have those thoughts in your heart, though I do obviously believe that we're all deeply flawed.
But you don't know, but who knows? Who knows what's in? I don't know what's in your heart. I don't know. I know you pretty well, John.
I'm sure there are
dark things.
Let me ask, we come at this from another side, which is that I often felt that the word lie was, you know, my fear is always if you always have the knob turned up to 10, then you can't go beyond that, despite what they say in Spinal Tap. And so, you know, that some of those words got cheapened and were applied to gray areas, leaving it unavailable for the punch it needs when it was truly, you know, when the president says he has talked to previous presidents who said the border wall was a good idea, that was a lie. He has actually not talked to them about that. And that's different than a kind of shading of something. In this case, it seems to me that you can use the word racist and racism because that's the verdict that Republicans have rendered. If you take those who are not Steve King and those who feel like he should leave the office, that the people of Iowa should be deprived of representation in these important committees that matter to them, these are, by the rules and standards they've created, big sanctions, a big deal. And so they have said that this is of this weight. They have decided, and if we're to treat them seriously, as they deserve to be treated seriously, then that word seems to me to be offered up, A, by their actions, and then B, going back to my previous point, requires the serious follow-ups that would be necessary if they are to be taken seriously for having taken this action because they've made this determination. So I think that it's a classification. You're really just classifying what the Republicans have chosen to do in response to his actions.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-hosts cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
So let's go to cocktail chatter when you have been censured by your family and have been exiled to the front porch of your house with just a drink and one companion. Emily, what will you be chattering to that one companion about?
I always feel like when you actually set this up and then I just say what I'm going to talk about, it's like humiliating because it just sounds like the most boring cocktail party in the world. But I have more to say about William Barr at this erstwhile cocktail party. You know, we're so focused on the Mueller investigation and these kind of basic rule of law questions that we're not even talking about all the policy issues that the attorney general touches and influences. So Barr asked about the bipartisan criminal justice reform that Congress passed in January, said yes, he would implement it, but he believes that the, you know, harsh sentencing penalties of the 80s and 90s are responsible for the decline in crime. There is little evidence to support that. I mean, they had some modest impact, small, but that as a characterization of why crime has declined in the United States is wrong and depressing. Barr also said that he thinks the criminal justice system is just as fair to Black people as it is to white people. There is a lot of evidence showing precisely the opposite. He also aligns with Trump on the wall, on the border, on denouncing sanctuary cities, so basically on immigration. He may not bring quite the same excitement to this topic as Jeff Sessions, but I don't think we're going to see any kind of policy shift in the Justice Department for this. And I just want to remind everyone that the Justice Department does all these other things that we need to be keeping an eye on.
John, what is your chatter?
My chatter is, it's log rolling. I don't do this much. I think. So
you don't much less than I do.
Well, we finally ran a piece that that I worked on last year in Charlottesville with Dave Matthews. When he was ending up his last tour in Charlottesville, I went down and talked to him about the $5 million that he's giving, part of the $40 million that he's given over the course of his career to various charities. But in this case, he's giving $5 million to basically try to jumpstart the low-cost housing process in Charlottesville. There are about 400 units in Charlottesville, all in need of significant repair. Buildings with elevators that don't work, the counters and kitchen areas are really in rough shape. They're all, you know, people living there, some of whom that I talked to, Joy Johnson and Audrey Oliver, who have been working for 20 years to try to get these improvements made. And the $5 million is hopefully going to kick off a new building area, which they can then move some residents into, demolish and rebuild the houses that they're in now. And it was a conversation about that good work, but then also about obviously what happened in Charlottesville, the city that gave him his birth in the world of music, and his reflections having grown up in South Africa, where he lived under apartheid, about race in America, about race in that particular city that he loves so much. I think it's a powerful conversation worth looking at. We'll post the link, or you can go to johndickerson.com and find it there. It's also on YouTube. And then also there's an outtake in which I asked him about where he finds the joy in music. And if you like hearing people talk about creativity, only a little bit of it is in the piece that ran on air, but he has about 4 minutes about where he finds joy in music. And it's a lovely answer.
The best part on the cutting room floor, but John has saved it for the masses.
That's right.
My chatter. This is going to be a disillusioning chatter. So if you have small children in the room,
pets,
if you're an idealist, you may want to look away for a moment. So I remember loving Raiders of the Lost Ark. I really remember loving, of the blockbusters of my youth and the kind of the Jaws, Star Wars, E.T. universe that so defined late 70s, early 80s. It's the only one that survived to my adulthood untarnished in my memory. It's as rollicking and funny and joyful. And so it was with great pleasure that I arranged a nice movie night last Friday night for me and my wife and our 10-year-old and a friend of his who was sleeping over to watch Raiders of the Lost Ark. Oh my God, that movie is a disaster. It is the most disturbing, racist movie I have seen in a really long time. I mean, you expect
that
maybe
really a problem, that movie.
In like, you know, movies from the 1940s, but holy moly, every non-white person is represented as an unruly savage or a superstitious coward. The one woman in the movie is given this initial veneer. She's introduced with a veneer of sort of sassiness and brassiness and courage, but she quickly sheds that to become a screeching, pleading, pathetically needy a caricature. Only people with any strength and fortitude in it are white guys, even the Nazis, who are all given this omnicompetence and bravery and propulsive force. There's one non-white character who is heroic, who's helping an Egyptian guy who's helping Indy. And he is emasculated. He's utterly emasculated in a scene at the end of the movie where the mere fact that a white woman kisses him causes him to melt into this slobbering, addled mess, that just the mere touch of a white woman on this man's body is enough to render him a joke. It's embarrassing. It's like, thank God the world has changed. You watch and you're like, thank God the world has changed. This movie is an embarrassment. And if you were thinking of showing it to your children, do not, because it's a disgrace.
It's interesting because I also remembered really enjoying it. And I think it's Harrison Ford, his like swashbuckling character. When I was a kid and I saw it, that like brought me along and was super appealing. And I just didn't think about all the other stuff. And now everything else in the movie looms really large and Harrison Ford's charms are small.
You can go watch Lara Croft in Tomb Raider. Also, I wonder, and this is a shallow point, but that's my role. The special effects and what seemed beyond anything we'd be seen before all now seems very it doesn't spark the wonder that it might have when you were seeing it whenever it was. So it doesn't over. If there was something that could distract you from everything else you said, David, even right. that, you know, to modernize just doesn't seem, you know, it either seems implausible or not that impressive.
That's true. It's not. It's not terrible. It's not. It doesn't look like you know, some silent film from the 20s in that respect. The effects are okay. It's also. It was surprisingly violent. I had forgotten how violent it is. There's a lot less of the kind of playfulness than I remembered. It's very violent and very bloody, and visually shows you a lot of stuff in a way that, again, surprised me. Given that it's a 40-year-old movie. So anyway, don't see Raiders. Do not see Raiders. The kids didn't notice at all. The kids just liked it. The kids, none of the racist part of it registered with them. So maybe.
Did you point it out or just let it go?
And we were pointing it out as it was going along, but they were just enjoying it. So they were like, wow, look at all those snakes. So we also, of course, dear listeners, are collecting your listener chatters, some work of culture, some episodes, some article you read that you think is worthy of discussion at your cocktail party. And you've been tweeting those to us at Slate Gabfest. It's a highlight of our week to get them. And there are a lot of good ones again this week. And I would like to call out one from Kathy Kearns at kkearns11542 on Twitter. And she points us to a story done by the StoryCorps, the public radio StoryCorps, about this strange and heartbreaking episode back in 1963 in Georgia, where the police arrested more than a dozen girls who were participating in a peaceful civil rights protest, a dozen girls who were 12 to 15 years old, and took them and held them in a stockade in another city for 2 months, didn't tell their parents where they'd taken them, didn't file any charges against them, just took them away. They were all African-American girls, took them away and just locked them in a stockade with essentially no toilet, very little food, no sanitation, no way for them to clean themselves. It's fairly shocking. It's fairly shocking, even by the dismal standards of the civil rights movement. So check it out on StoryCorps. It's the story of the Leesburg Stockade Girls. The Leesburg Stockade Girls. That is our show for today. The Gabfest is produced by Jocelyn Frank. Our researcher is Bridget Dunlap. June Thomas is the managing producer of Slate Podcasts. And Gabriel Roth is the editorial director of audio at Slate. You can follow us on Twitter at Slate Gabfest and tweet your chatter to us. Remember, we have a live show in Washington coming up on March 27th. Go to slate.com/live to get tickets for that show. For Emily and John, I'm David Plotz. Thank you for listening. We'll talk to you next week.
Ever listen to podcasts with your kids? It's a great way to keep them entertained and engage their minds without relying on screens. I want to tell you about a new kids' history podcast hosted by me, Joy Dolo. It's called Forever Ago, and I teamed up with the producers of the award-winning kids' podcast, Brains On, to make it. Forever Ago dives into the amazing backstories of everyday stuff, like emojis, video games, and skateboards. We use games, skits, and kid co-hosts to keep the whole family engaged while teaching listeners to think critically about history. Along the way, we'll hear some incredible stories, like how a curious teenager revolutionized skateboarding.
Gnarly.
How alarm clocks used to just be people. Rise and shine. And how the poop emoji almost didn't happen. You can find Forever Ago on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.
I'm Dahlia Lithwick, and I'm host of Amicus, Slate's podcast about the law and the U.S. Supreme Court. We are shifting into high gear, coming at you weekly with the context you need to understand the rapidly changing legal landscape. The many trials of Donald J. Trump, judicial ethics, arguments and opinions at SCOTUS. We are tackling the big legal news with clarity and insight every single week. New Amicus episodes every Saturday, wherever you listen.